This financial agreement frustrated Herod, but as Josephus tells us, Herod did not want to make an enemy of Cleopatra, and so he ended up upholding it. Yet, it was also at this time that he began to ponder a possibility that he could apply to Cleopatra the same approach that he took to other obstacles. In other words, he began to argue to his council that he should kill her. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 63, King Herod and Queen Cleopatra. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. The time has come to compare Herod with another powerful person in the region, one of the most famous monarchs in the history of the world, Cleopatra. The stories of these two ruthless, gifted individuals would intertwine in a variety of ways throughout the years, and while the similarities between them may not seem immediately obvious, a study of Stacy Schiff's justly celebrated biography of the Queen of Egypt allows us to see what they are. First, there is the fact that Cleopatra did not descend from Egyptians. Rather, she was of the line of the Greek general Ptolemy, overseeing a country that was so much older than her own family, constantly negotiating with Rome in order to preserve her power. Thus, Schiff writes, quote, "Like all lives that lend themselves to poetry, Cleopatra's was one of dislocations and disappointments. She grew up amid unsurpassed luxury to inherit a kingdom in decline. For 10 generations, her family had styled themselves pharaohs. The Ptolemies were in fact Macedonian Greek, which makes Cleopatra approximately as Egyptian as Elizabeth Taylor. At 18, Cleopatra and her 10-year-old brother assumed control of a country with a weighty past and a wobbly future. 1,300 years separate Cleopatra from Nefertiti. The pyramids, to which Cleopatra almost certainly introduced Julius Caesar, already sported graffiti. The Sphinx had undergone a major restoration 1,000 years earlier, and the glory of the once great Ptolemaic Empire had dimmed. Cleopatra came of age in a world shadowed by Rome, which in the course of her childhood extended its rule to Egypt's borders." End quote. In a similar sense, Herod, who ruled a Judean kingdom, had an Arab mother and descended on his father's side from Idumean converts. He was neither of the line of David nor of the Hasmoneans, but he would set his sights on another incredibly ancient city, Jerusalem, and rule Judea from there. Of course, the commonalities between Cleopatra and Herod and the fact that Judea and Egypt were neighboring states and both under the hegemony of Rome would ensure that a real rivalry existed between them. And we will draw today on Schiff's fascinating book in order to understand the next chapter of Jerusalem's story, as the Eternal City continues to connect with so many famous men and women in the history of the world. When we last left off, the Hasmonean Aristobulus, with the help of the Parthians, had conquered Jerusalem, killed Herod's older brother, Phasaelus, and maimed the high priest Hyrcanus, his uncle. Herod escaped, took refuge at Masada, and then journeyed to Egypt. There he convinced the queen to furnish him with a fleet, which he used to journey to Rome. Schiff's description conjures up for us the meeting and the moment. Quote, "Herod made his way finally to Alexandria, where Cleopatra received him in style. She knew him primarily as an excitable friend of Antony's and as a fellow Roman client, but had additional reason to be favorably disposed toward him. Herod's father had twice assisted in Ptolemaic restorations, both hers and that of her father. In 47, he had personally launched a vigorous, artful assault on the eastern frontier and rallied Egypt's Jews to Caesar's cause. Like their fathers, Cleopatra and Herod were former Pompeians, late converts to Caesar. They had a common enemy in the Parthians. Herod was moreover an entertaining companion, glib and keen, fanatical in his loyalties, expert in his displays of deference. Evidently, Cleopatra attempted to enlist the dashing prince in an expedition, either of her own into Ethiopia or with Antony in Parthia. It was unsurprising that she should offer him a command. Jewish officers had long served in the Ptolemaic forces, and Herod was particularly distinguished. An expert horseman, he could throw a javelin with unerring precision. He declined the offer. In the end, Cleopatra supplied him with a galley. She seemed forever to be handing out ships, in which to make a risky winter crossing to Rome, an unusual kind of hospitality, and one that involved Herod in a shipwreck off the coast of Cyprus. He washed up in Rome only weeks later, to be welcomed warmly by Octavian and Antony." End quote. Here again, another comparison between Cleopatra and Herod presents itself. Cleopatra had built her career through incredible ability to turn the Romans to her favor. This she did first with Julius Caesar, who took her side against her brother, and then with Antony. Herod, in his own way, had a unique gift for convincing Roman after Roman that Judea's place within the empire would be best preserved with Herod in charge. The fact that the Jewish masses did not wish to be led by Herod mattered little to Rome. It helped, of course, that Herod had been battling in Jerusalem against Rome's enemy, Parthia. Therefore, what unfolded in Rome, though shocking, can perhaps be understood. The leaders of the Roman Empire proclaimed Herod king of Jerusalem in a massive ceremony. Schiff writes, quote, To the same end, Antony and Octavian had together arranged a kingship for Herod when he had finally washed up in Rome that winter. Of Idumean and Arab descent, Herod was by no means the obvious candidate for the Judean throne. His tenacity, rather than his heritage, secured him the crown. No dynast more eloquently explained away his misguided loyalty to Cassius. It would fairly be said of Herod that he had slinked into power. Antony had known his father, also a friend to Rome, and he had met Herod as a teenager. The personal rapport counted for a good deal. A rough-edged opportunist, Herod was endearingly reckless, a master of the miraculous escape. The evidence suggests a fascination with him in Rome, on Octavian's part as much as on Antony's. Not coincidentally, Herod was as much a swashbuckler when it came to raising funds as throwing a javelin. He had an astonishing talent for plucking gold from thin air. His subjects had some insight into his methods. The Senate unanimously confirmed the kingship, after which Octavian and Antony escorted Herod between them to the capital, a signal honor. Consuls and magistrates led the way, end quote. Now, of course, Cleopatra had a connection with Antony that Herod could not claim. And as with Caesar, she would become pregnant in a relationship with this new Roman leader. But politically, Cleopatra's relationship with Antony also gave Herod an advantage, for others in Rome were suspicious of the queen and her hold over Antony. Thus, as Schiff writes, quote, by some accounts, Herod owed his throne equally to Cleopatra. The Senate was as much motivated by fear of her as by admiration of him. They distinctly preferred two monarchs in the region to one, end quote. Antony then furnished Herod with an enormous army with which to reconquer Jerusalem from the Hasmonean Aristobulus. And reconquer it he did, pausing only to marry the granddaughter of Hyrcanus, Mariam, thereby affiliating his own line with that of the Maccabee dynasty. Simon Sebag Montefiore gives us a succinct summation of the events. Quote, after a 40-day siege, the Romans stormed the outer wall. 2 weeks later, they burst into the temple, ravaging the city like a company of madmen, cutting down the Jerusalemites in the narrow streets. Herod had to bribe the Romans to stop the slaughter, and then sent the captured Antigonus to Antony, who solicitously beheaded the last Maccabean king. And Montefiore adds, King Herod celebrated his conquest of Jerusalem by liquidating 45 of the 71 members of the Sanhedrin. End quote. Thus we find a terrible fulfillment of the prediction of the sage Simmaeus before the Sanhedrin, that one day Herod would threaten them all. We will ponder next week what this must have done for Jewish tradition, suddenly having so many sages murdered. Around 36 BCE, in Schiff's account, Cleopatra, fresh from a meeting with Antony, north of Judea, stopped in Jerusalem on the way home to Egypt. There, the two monarchs, king and queen, so alike and yet so different, engage in intense negotiations over Middle Eastern resources, a fascinating parallel to negotiations in the Middle East today. Schiff again, quote, Antony had granted Cleopatra the exclusive right to the Dead Sea bitumen, or asphalt, glutinous lumps of which floated to the surface of the lake. Bitumen was essential to mortar, incense, and insecticide, to embalming and caulking. A reed basket smeared with asphalt could hold water. Plastered with it, a boat is waterproof. The concession was a lucrative one. Also Cleopatra's were the proceeds of Jericho, the popular winter resort, lush with date palm groves and balsam gardens. Very likely she rode out across a searing desert to inspect those 200 acres in the Jordan River Valley, where Herod had a secondary palace. All other scents paled in comparison to sweet balsam, which grew exclusively in Judea. The fragrant shrub's oil, seed, and bark were precious. They constituted the region's most valuable export. As for Jericho's dates, they were the finest in the ancient world, the source of its most potent wine. In modern terms, it was as if Cleopatra had been granted no part of Kuwait, only the proceeds of its oil fields. Herod found the transaction particularly painful, as Judea was a poor country, parched and stony, with few fertile areas, no port, and a rapidly expanding population. His revenues were a risible fraction of Cleopatra's, end quote. Thus, this financial agreement frustrated Herod, but as Josephus tells us, Herod did not want to make an enemy of Cleopatra, and so he ended up upholding it. Yet, it was also at this time that he began to ponder a possibility that he could apply to Cleopatra the same approach that he took to other obstacles. In other words, he began to argue to his council that he should kill her. As Josephus puts it, quote, in this way, he said, he would rid of many evils all those to whom she had already been vicious or was likely to be in future. At the same time, he argued, this would be a boon to Antony, for not even to him would she show loyalty if some occasion or need should compel him to ask for it, end quote. Herod further insisted to his council that Cleopatra had tried to seduce him, as she had Caesar and Antony. To all this, the council responded, cogently and coherently, that the murder of a monarch who was pregnant at the time with the child of Antony, one of the leaders of Rome, would not redound well for Herod or Judea. In other words, the members of the council told the insane monarch that he was being, well, insane. Reading Schiff's book, it is hard not to wonder about the countless counterfactuals. What might have happened had this intended regicide occurred? Would Herod have been overthrown by Anthony? And would a different, less murderous monarch have emerged in Jerusalem? Would Anthony himself not have been defeated with Cleopatra by Octavian in the future? It is impossible to know. And Herod, instead of killing Cleopatra, listened to his council's advice and escorted the queen out of the country. Schiff's gloss on the proposed assassination is interesting. Quote, assuming these deliberations reached Cleopatra's ears, it is difficult not to hear her cackling with delight. She had and knew she had Anthony's loyalty. She had better reason to consider disposing of Herod, who alone stood between her and full possession of the eastern coastline. As she well knew, his land had at several junctures belonged to the Ptolemies. End quote. Thus ended Cleopatra's visit to Jerusalem, and we can now add her to the many monarchs whose story intersects with that of the sacred city. But if Cleopatra, as Schiff puts it, would have cackled with delight hearing about Herod's proposed assault on her, we may well think of the Yiddish version of the phrase man proposes, God disposes, which is a Mensch tracht und Gott lacht, man thinks and God laughs. And the truth is that this wily leader, this queen of Egypt, would soon find her own dynasty destroyed at the hands of Antony's rival Octavian. Meanwhile, Herod would switch sides again, his gift for turning Romans to him made manifest once more. And as we shall see next week, Herod will himself see to the end of another dynasty, one that had reigned in Jerusalem. But as we shall also see next week, it will be under Herod that the dynasty of another Jew will rise, that of the humble Hillel, who will bring glory to Judaism and achieve immortality in Jewish tradition, the likes of which Herod can never dream. For Hillel will ensure the eternity of all that Jerusalem embodies. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, looking forward to learning together next week, signing off.